Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
It was the first year of the chicanes on the Mulsanne, and it played into our hands. Most of the cars had the downforce stripped down for straight line speed, but we put more wing on, and it made the car quicker over the lap. We still got up to around 225 miles an hour, though, and I hadn't driven anything more powerful than an F3 car until that year. These are the words of a British motor racing legend, but perhaps best known as a British touring car star, Anthony Reid, describing his early experience of the 1990 Le Mans 24 Hours, which he selected as his race of my life to Autosport in 2009. And this pick is the latest in our Race of My Life mini-series. I'm your host, Alex Kanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today are two guests. The first is Autosport's longtime sports car guru, Gary Watkins, who was at that race in 1990. Your first 24-hour race of any capacity, am I right thinking that, Gary?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, it was my first time at Le Mans. A momentous moment in my career, I guess. Unfortunately, I missed Le Mans without the chicanes. The sort of Mulsanne straight in its full majesty, but there you go, nothing I can do about that. I guess I'm just not old enough, which it's rare that I can say that about anything, so but there you go. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, to introduce my second guest, I'm excited and delighted to say is the man himself, whose words I was reading earlier, Anthony Reid. You say that you credit this race, the 1990 Le Mans 24 Hours, as where your racing career really began. So perhaps we could start with what had occurred before that, if you could just talk us through your early career and how you ended up driving in that particular race.
Yeah, the my racing career really started in 1976, but of course I wasn't being paid to race. I had to raise my own money. In 1977, I won the Jim Russell World Scholarship. There was a panel of judges, very illustrious panel of judges, including Jack Sears, Derek Bell, I think Alan Henry was there, and Nigel Roebuck. Colin Chapman was meant to be on the chair of the judging committee, but he had a last-minute call-up or business engagement, so he didn't make it. But it was those judges that selected me as one of the top students of the year, and that paid for a full season of racing, 1978, in the Esso Formula 4 Championship based at Silverstone. I had to go and work in the oil business to get the money to go racing, because after the prize drive finished at the end of 1978, I didn't have any money to continue racing. So I went and, over a three-year period, worked in the oil business on the Shetland Islands to get the money to buy a racing car and to continue racing. When I came back down, I joined John Kirkpatrick Racing in 1982 and raced Formula Ford. And then 83 Formula Ford, and also 84 Formula Ford 2000. And at that point, Damon Hill had joined the team. So for the winter series, he was my teammate. I didn't pay too much attention to who he was and his background. I was kind of, like any young racing driver, totally focused on my own performance. I seem to remember Damon was always at the back of the grid. I mean, he'd just come out of motorcycle racing. And I was up at the front winning, racing against people like Martin Donnelly and Julian Bailey. Then I got a break to race in Formula 3 for the Saab Formula 3 team, but that turned out to be a bit of a disaster. That was in 1985 with Magic Motorsport. My teammates included Maurizio Sandrosana and Julian Bailey in 85. But beyond that, I then really struggled because the season had been a bit of a disaster. I mean, towards the end of that year, this guy, Bob Moore, that had persuaded Saab that they couldn't afford not to go Formula 3 racing. Don't think they'd really done any serious motorsport outside of rallying up until that point. Towards the end of that year, there were three cars in the team, myself, Julian Bailey, and Maurizio Sandrosana, and we were at Snetterton. And for some reason, Bob Moore had invited 200 guests from Saab to come and watch the race. He set up a hospitality suite on the inside of the first corner, Riches. And when the flag, I think it was still flags in those days that started the race, I can't remember. When the flag dropped, as we came flying into the first corner, Julian was on the row behind me and hit the back of my car, and that caused me to hit the back of Maurizio Sandrosana's car. And this guy, Bob Moore, had built us, you know, built up the sort of guests into a bit of a frenzy because he sort of persuaded them that we'd somehow win the race. And all three of us crashed in front of all these guests at the first corner. And that really was the straw that broke the camel's back.
But Anthony, you didn't mention living in the pits at Brands Hatch there in the very early 80s, which we talked about.
During the period that I was working in the oil business, so I'd be sort of going up and coming back to do some racing as I earned money. And to sort of cut my overheads, and I'd been used to living in a tent in the Shetlands anyway, you could hire a garage or sublet it in the pit lane at Brands Hatch for, I think it was a fiver a week. And you got at least 2 free days of testing. So it made complete sense. But I wasn't the only person living in or at the back behind the garages. There was a whole community of up to maybe 10 people. I often wonder what happened to these characters. But, it, you know, racing was relatively affordable compared to how it is now, unless you're a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. But the more... well-heeled drivers used to stay in a guest house called Red's, and that was in West Kingsdown, very close to the Clearways Cafe. Was a great place. It's now an Indian restaurant, but there was a, you know, we'd all meet up there for meal times, breakfast and what have you. So it really was, you know, it wasn't as grim as it sounded. It was actually good fun.
Even though you told me you only had running cold water, not running hot water in your pit.
That's right. They had built a toilet block pretty much where the control tower is now at Brands Hatch. And I think that might have had... There was no showers, I don't think, but basic toilet facilities. And I think that might well have included some hot water. So somehow I survived. But, I mean, I remember, I think it was Barry Sheen. I was in Garage 18, the old pits, which actually aren't that much different from the ones that they've got there now. And I remember Barry Sheen waiting for me to clear my garage. It must have been one of the big bike race meetings, because that was his pit garage for the weekend. Yeah, so the only time we had to move out was for the British Grand Prix or the bike Grand Prix in those days.
So your big break, though, really was came courtesy of Bo Strandell and the Convector team in 1990 to do those handful of Group C races. And of course, you know, things like this are always sort of domino effects, aren't they? And that in turn led to the Alfa Porsche gig at Le Mans. So I've always wondered, how did the Convector thing come up?
Well, it sort of dates back to, it's one of those extraordinary things that I sort of put my last money, that I've been racing in 89 in Vauxhall Lotus, and I put my last money into to Peter Thompson, and he ran me at the British Grand Prix. And it so happened that Opel paid whatever fee they had to make it the main support race. So the Formula 3 race was run the previous day during qualifying, I mean, on the same qualifying day as Formula 1. So our race was run, I think, about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, that morning, as the main support race to the British Grand Prix. I'd stuck it on pole, and I won the race by 7 seconds. And it was the cream of the crop of all the European Opel Lotus, Vauxhall Lotus drivers were all there. And Bo Strandall happened to watch it on satellite television. He watched me win this race. And a few weeks later, I happened to be out of the house. I was sharing a house with my brother in the centre of Oxford. And my brother was hopeless at taking messages. But on this occasion, we didn't have an answer machine. He happened to be in. He took Bo Strandell's name and wrote down his telephone number. So when I got back in later, well, the following day, I phoned this guy up. I didn't know who he was. And he said, oh, it's a good job you called back, because I was going to call the next guy on the list. We're going to set up a Group C team the following year. And we're looking for drivers. Would you like to come down to a test at Monza? And I said, hell yes. And so I think the following week I went down for this test at Monza. And I remember pulling up at the back of the pits, and there was only one parking space that wasn't taken, and it had written Enzo Ferrari on it. All the other spaces were taken by the other teams that were testing there. So I had to park around the back somewhere. But anyway, after, I think there was only about three of us, there was Harry Toivonen, Bent Track Rod, and myself.
Just to interrupt, Bent Track Rod was not the guy's real name. It was, I think it was Bengt Tragaf, yes. that's what he was coined when he raced in England, wasn't it? That was his nickname.
But clearly I must have auditioned well. I remember being comfortably the fastest of those drivers. And then the following week, they said, right, we can't afford to pay you, but it won't cost you anything, and you can race in the World Sports Car Championship for Group C cars the following year. In fact, I think they had a little bit of a budget constraint, so we only did the European races, which was about seven of them. So I did three races. I think it was Monza, Spa, and Silverstone, before I got a phone call from Tiffany Dell.
This is the phone call that's referenced in the magazine in Race of Your Life Choice.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Often teammates are responsible for another driver getting a break at some point down the road, so that's why it's never a good idea to fall out with fellow racers if you can possibly help it, because you never know how things might turn out. So I'd had sufficient Group C experience, and I got the call up 2 weeks before Le Mans, and Derek Bell had a last minute call up by the Yost factory team to go and race for them. So Tiff and the Alpha team were short of a driver, and I had by that stage sufficient Group C experience that they thought it would be a good choice. And I can honestly say that race changed my life, because from being a sort of struggling amateur driver, that was the first race that I ever got paid, and I think it was something like 12,000 quid, which was a lot of money in those days, 30 years ago. Because of the success and we finished on the podium, that took me out to Japan.
Just get a bit of background to the 1990 Le Mans race and how things had gone ahead of the action starting.
Yeah, well, just a little background about Anthony's drive with the Alpha team. The background to the whole deal is that it was sort of Tiff's drive. And he was initially going to share in the full Japanese season with Kostas Loss, who was a sort of Anglo-Greek who did quite a lot of sports car racing. I think Kostas didn't quite prove up to it, which is... And then Derek was going to do the long races, including the long races in Japan. He did the Fuji 1000. So really, there were two slots. So David Sears was brought in. And then at the last minute, when Derek got taken over to the sort of pseudo works Yost team, that's when you came in. So that's the sort of the background to the whole Alpha Porsche gig.
Yeah. And how did you find the weekend starting, Anthony, and all the preparation for Le Mans? You mentioned it's the first time you know racing in a car of that nature before.
I mean, it was just the most fabulous experience, not just because of the result, but it's an entire week out of your life. The scrutineering in the town centre. I mean, this was all a huge assault on my senses because I'd never really seen anything like this before on this grand scale, you know, to the number of spectators, to the speed and scale of the track. So the one thing I do remember, because they didn't have pre-Le Mans testing, so I had to gain my rookie experience during the process of qualifying. So I had to complete 10 continuous laps, and a number of laps at night, to qualify to race in the race. I don't think you can do that now because there's a kind of qualifying process if you haven't raced there for a number of years.
Well, yeah, Gary, is it right? You go to ART these days. They help get the rookies acclimatized.
Yeah, everyone has to do a simulator, every newcomer. So that included Fernando Alonso, Mark Webber. So they have to do a half-day simulator session, which as well as sort of, it's not so much about teaching people the track, it's about teaching people the procedures, which I think is significant, because at Le Mans these days, and in your day, Anthony, there are a lot of things that are specific to Le Mans, you know, free safety cars, for example, you know, coming at you, not just out of the pit lane. So I think that's significant. And the way they handle certain situations. Of course, now we have the slow zones, these sort of temporary virtual safety car zones where you have to slow to 80 kilometers an hour. So there's a lot that's different about Le Mans. So I think that makes sense. And of course, in normal years, when we have the Le Mans test day, which we won't be having this year, again, rookies are meant to do that. For a while, all rookies had to do it. But for quite a few years now, if you're platinum rated, you can ask for dispensation not to do it. So there have been quite a few platinum graded drivers who haven't done the test day.
Yeah, I remember that. So I early on, it must have been on the Wednesday afternoon, I was doing my 10 laps early on, and halfway through I came across what looked like an aircraft accident on the Mulsanne Strait. What had happened was that Jonathan Palmer's rear suspension collapsed, and the car literally took off and went into the trees and then was bounced back onto the circuit. But I mean, the debris field must have been something like 300 or 400 meters. It was incredible. So, and there was no way through, so I had to stop on the track. There was this big discussion suddenly cropped up because there'd been a suspect bolt, and I think Porsche were on the rear suspension, and Porsche were making up some titanium ones to replace this particular bolt, which was deemed to be slightly suspect. But of course, we didn't have those replacement bolts. They weren't going to come until the following day. So I had to carry on acclimatizing, doing my rookie test at Le Mans, in the knowledge that one of the bolts might go on the rear suspension. That was just one thing that came to mind.
The big thing about that year, of course, was the first year of the chicanes. You're talking there about the Yerst car, which Jonathan Palmer was driving. The factory decided that even though there were now two chicanes on the 4 mile and Mulsanne Strait, and that cars wouldn't be doing 240 miles an hour anymore, they still decided to go with a long tail setup. And that was what they were advising their customers to go with. But Alpha and a few other teams, most notably Brun Motorsport, who very nearly finished second in that race, went with a sort of what we would call a hybrid setup, a short tail, but with a sort of a shallower rear wing. So it looked like the high downforce car, but it had, I know, for example, the Alpha team built their own rear wing, which was I do remember Gordon Horn, the team manager, where he was involved in a composites business, and he had that made. Bruin obviously were a big team, and they did their own sort of rear wing, and clearly the higher downforce setup worked. It changed the dynamic of the race entirely. The Yost cars were buggering up their tyres because of the lack of downforce.
Yeah, the genius thing that my team did, the Alpha team, was that they brought both sets of bodywork all the way from Japan to the event. So we had the luxury of doing a back-to-back and looking at all the data and stuff. Obviously not so much data in those days, but a lot of it was down to the driver's feeling. And I remember having a big discussion on the Thursday, it must have been actually the Friday morning, which bodywork were we going to use. I was adamant, because I'd never been to Le Mans before. I just loved the feel of the higher downforce setup. It gave you more confidence, and you could brake later for the chicanes, which was and the tyre runs were very good. The long bodywork, the car was very floaty. It was like driving a waterbed, and squirmy in the braking areas. And, you know, clearly you were rubbing out the tyres with the lower downforce setup.
I spoke to Tiff about this quite recently, and he takes credit for the aero specification that ran on your car that year, because he was saying he looked at Fuji in those days is a much quicker circuit than it is today, but it still has the long straight, and he looked at Fuji and thought, and then looked at the new Le Mans with two chicanes on the Mulsanne. And he basically thought, well, Fuji is one third of Le Mans. So whatever we do at Fuji will be relevant to Le Mans. And so he suggested that they try a higher downforce setup. And he was saying that they actually back-to-back them much earlier in the year at Fuji. And he said the times were not dissimilar, but the higher downforce car with the short tail was a much more comfortable car to drive. And clearly that's going to be key, isn't it, over a 24-hour race?
Yeah, I guess it must have been Tiff's insistence that we took both sets of bodywork to the event.
Now, Anthony, you mentioned in the Race of My Life feature that you didn't qualify well. Now, obviously, you're having to learn the track and get your rookie status during in that. But what happened in the qualifying session?
Tiff would probably be better qualified to answer that, because he did the actual qualifying runs for the time on the softer tyre.
Most people, of course, would have a qualifying engine, run a bit more boost. But apparently you opted not to run a qualifying engine. So Tiff actually qualified 20th. Which is, and Tiff told me, I thought I'd better get a move on in the opening laps of the race. So he actually overtook quite a few cars in the first few laps, I think, just to keep the man writing the checks happy. And actually, at the end of the opening hour, you were up to 15th.
Yes. Now, Tiff made great progress in that first stint.
And then how did the race unfold from there?
Well, we decided to run a strategy of changing the driver at every stint for some reason, which doesn't really happen these days. But you had quite a long fueling time, getting 80 or 100 litres. 100 litres of fuel in, so you probably had about 1 minute and 20 seconds to comfortably, you know, change tyres and change drivers. And we just kept that going throughout the entire race. I do remember the weather being particularly hot, so it was quite a good thing, actually, early on in the afternoon and the early evening, so you could replenish yourself and refresh yourself. But it seemed to work very well.
It was unheard of then, though, actually, really, to do... I mean, even if you were single stinting during the day, people would always go to double stints at the night. And it's really unusual why you went that way. Do you remember the engineer, Gary Cummings?
Yes, Gary Cummings and Martin Rafoff.
Was Rafoff involved, was he?
Yes, he was for that race.
Oh, really? Of course, Rafoff is a long time IMSA official who's held just about every job there is going at IMSA and is still involved today. So he was, sort of a weekend warrior, because he's good friends with Gary.
Yes. I could see that there were, obviously I was new to the team, but I could see that they were a great partnership, because Martin was very good on the numbers and checking the fuel consumption.
Mm-hmm. Another guy who was involved in that as a weekend warrior, just as a teenager, was Vincent Beaumanil, who is now sporting director of the ACO. So isn't that amazing that he actually met Mark Rafoff, a sort of almost his opposite number at IMSA, 30 years ago. We actually ran a story in Autosport, a picture in Autosport last year in the Le Mans supplement, and there's a picture of Vincent standing on the rear wing, not on the rear wing, by the rear wing of your car, sort of ahead of scrutineering. I think he's sort of pushing it up to be checked over. I mean, one thing about that race that you didn't mention in your race of my life, I think, is that the only delay that year was a cracked screen. And I'm told that you ended up with glass in your eye.
Yeah, I was getting a slipstream off a Mazda, one of the rotary engine cars. They weren't particularly quick that year, presumably because of the balance of performance or whatever. And as I was getting a tow from behind, a wing mirror fell off this Mazda on the Mulsanne Strait. You know, we would have been doing over 200 miles an hour, and it smacked the middle of the screen, not directly in my line of sight, so it didn't really affect the ability to be able to see the the circuit ahead of you. But like most drivers, I drove with the visor open, being a closed cockpit car, and I got showered with tiny fragments of glass. I mean, we never had to replace the windscreen, obviously.
Oh, is that right? You didn't replace it?
No.
Oh, okay.
So we just, I think, might have put some helicopter tape over the smack and carried on, being a triplex screen or whatever. And so that necessitated a trip to the medical centre at the end of that stint. So it was before nightfall that this happened. It was still daylight, sort of in the evening at some point. So I had to get my eye rinsed to get the glass out. It was a little bit uncomfortable. You know, on adrenaline, you're sort of pumped up and you don't, feel the pain.
I mean, obviously the race sort of came to you, didn't it? Because it was a bit of a race of attrition. You mentioned the heat there. In the early hours of the morning, as you sort of gradually crept up the leaderboard, what were you thinking was possible?
I was thinking anything might be possible, because the race really was wide open. In the opening half of the race, you had all these different manufacturers, Toyota, Nissan, Jaguar, Mazda, and of course Porsche. And it really was a titanic battle of makes throughout, the into the evening. I mean, there were some very big crashes. One of the Toyotas crashed in front of the pits. There was a Lancia that crashed into the woods in the middle of the night. And this is coming down to Indianapolis. And it set fire to the trees. And I was going, my God, what is this sort of race? I'd never seen anything like it before. And then James Weaver's car caught fire and came into the pits in the middle of the night. And the pits were very narrow. And this flaming car.
That was before the new pits that we know today. So this was the pits that were built in 1956.
The Steve McQueen pits.
Yeah, exactly.
So the most, really was just an extraordinary 24-hour period. All these things. And I thought, that we could do very well here. What the Jaguar didn't really show their hand until sort of well into the night, I seem to remember. It wasn't until well into the night and after one or two big crashes, like the Brancatelli car, that it became clear that it was going to come between Porsche and Jaguar, although Jaguar were sort of the favourites, I guess, after a certain point in the night.
One thing I wanted to mention, just very very briefly, from what you mentioned in the Race of My Life feature for Autosport magazine, is that you felt that you could have perhaps got second place had you had more of the softer tyres available. So what could you just talk us through that briefly?
Well, the Brun car was kind of the factory favourite for Yokohama. They were running Yokohama and we were running Yokohama. But they got, there was a sort of limited allocation of tyres, and particularly the softer, the tyre that we would have used at night. So we were running harder tyres than they were for much of the race. But when we got the softer tyres, we could immediately feel how much quicker they were, you know, particularly at night. That they were worth, I don't know, 2 or 3 seconds a lap at least, as far as I can remember. But of course, they piled all the tyres into the Brun car, and then the Brun car extraordinarily broke down with 15 minutes to go. So, yes, we just wish they'd had a few more of those soft tyres.
I mean, what was your thinking? Because there you were heading for fourth place, 15, 16 minutes to go. I think Tiff was in your car at the end, so you were in the pits, probably with a view of a TV or a big screen, and you saw the smoke billowing out of the Brun car down at Molsand Corner. I mean, what, did you think, blimey, I'm going to be on the podium at Le Mans?
Yeah, I was kind of stunned. I mean, given it was my first 24-hour race in a car that was doing well over 200 miles an hour at points on the lap, and all the things that had happened through the night, and I'd been living off adrenaline and not getting much sleep, I was completely shattered. And with the heat and everything, and we didn't have cool suits in those days or air conditioning. But I do remember when we saw the Brun car break down, we came from the Japanese hospitality suite above the pit garage, David and I, because they said, well, you better make your way down to the podium because it looks like you're going to be on the podium. We were just speechless. And so was David. And we just headed down to the podium, and the car came over the line, and there we were on one of the greatest podiums on the planet. It was quite remarkable.
And then that success leads on to the rest of your career, we've heard to say.
Yeah, because the Alpha team liked what I did and invited me over for rounds of the Japanese Group C Championship. So, you know, I was racing with Derek Bell as a teammate, and Tiffany Dell and myself. Quite amazing at circuits like Suzuka and Fuji. And the guy, Tommy Sport, that ran the actual car, they were the team, but were big in Formula 3. And they said, come and race Formula 3 for us. So in 1992, I went over and won the Japanese Formula 3 championship. You've got to remember, there was quite a large crowd of European and American drivers racing in Japan. We didn't know it then, but a lot of those drivers were going to go on and race in Formula 1, you know, the likes of Eddie Irvine, Jacques Villeneuve, Tom Christensen, or other platforms of motorsport, Rickard Rydell, even the Schumacher brothers. I raced a season of GT against Ralph Schumacher, Michael Schumacher. He came over and did a few races in Japanese Formula 3 and Formula 3000. It was just a great period. And Adam Cooper was based in Tokyo. And I credit him with the coverage that he gave us whilst we raced in Europe in autosport, sorry, in Japan, for bringing some of these drivers back to Europe.
One of our reporters, Adam Cooper, still on the F1 beat, and he every now and then he'll post a picture on Twitter of various European drivers over there in Japan. I mean, a key point of the Race of My Life podcast that we've been doing is that we sort of have a debate about what other drivers could have selected as alternative races, you know, famous wins, famous drives that also happened in their career. I wondered, as we've got you here, Anthony, I mean, I can completely understand why this race, you picked it for Autosport magazine, but were there any other sort of candidates that come close that you could have gone with?
And I think I did this race of my life. It must have been 25 years ago when I was racing in the BBC Grandstand Series. There was a race where I hadn't qualified particularly well, and then I wasn't happy with my engine. I put this engine in the back of my car, and the mechanics did, the team did, and it's quite extraordinary because I've been struggling with a bit of understeer in Druids, and I was like 6 tenths off the pace in qualifying when I went out. The thing had power oversteer in the hairpin, and I put it on pole. Don't think I had a good start, and I got passed by Martin Donnelly and Julian Bailey. Then I tried to pass in clearways, and Martin Donnelly took off my front wing. Not both wings, but just one half of the wing. So then, you know, I was struggling a little bit with handling, but I got into the groove, got my head down, got past Donnelly by overtaking him around the outside of Druids, and then passed Julian on the inside of clearways a couple of laps later. And won the race.
Yeah, while we're talking about Le Mans, you know, of course, more than 10 years later, the 2 years with the MG 675 car, LMP 675 car, I mean, you know, ultimately that car didn't deliver the results, but it was fast but fragile. I mean, I remember some heroics from a lot of the drivers there, especially including you, in the rain in 2001. Do you have good memories of that year?
2002 was with the second year with the LMP 675. That was tremendous. When the car stayed together, we didn't have any problems with the car. In the opening stint, we managed to get ahead of the Bentleys and stuff like that. And throughout the afternoon and into the evening, we actually split the works Audis by running in third place. The race was dry that year, unlike the previous year. I think Warren Hughes got into the car shortly after midnight, and he was flying. We were running aggregate in third place, backwards and forwards. And some minor thing on the gearbox broke, and the car retired. That was it. So we were out of the race. But having held our head high by having run in third place with a British car, and the British crowd loved it, and they really were supporting the MG team. Because I said to my teammates, there was a bit of politicking going on between Mark Blundell's car. They were trying to get us to go slowly, but my wife got involved in the conversation, actually. And suddenly we were given permission to do what we liked in the race. And I said to Warren Hughes and Johnny Kane, I said, look, we could drive around here at 5 miles an hour. The car's still going to break down, so let's just thrash the car's arse. We absolutely caned it.
Warren tells a great story about that year. He wasn't sort of really sure what was going on. I think this was at the end of his first stint. He came into the pits, and at the moment he stopped, his car was sort of mobbed by photographers and film crews, and he thought, something must be going on here. And that's when he realised he was, you know, running in amongst the Audis. Yeah. I guess he was told, yeah.
Yeah, that's the other memory I have from racing in the Porsche 962 in 1990. Was, you know, in the last few hours of the race, suddenly every time we came into the pits, we were surrounded by film crew, which also told me the same thing. We must be doing something right.
Good clue there to see that some success is on the horizon. I wondered, you know, any particular of your British touring car successes you would highlight as a potential alternative candidate?
Yeah, well, there was one race which was a bit controversial, but it was, I think it was July 1998 or August on the club circuit at Brands. I'd qualified second for the feature race. So Rickard got into the lead. And as we came into Druids, it was very tight, but I was immediately behind him. And he sort of brake tested me and backed me into the pack. So I was swamped, and I was pushed back into about seventh place. So I got my head down, was determined to catch Rickard. Started passing people, you know, menus, John Clones, people like that, coming into paddock. And then the team made a great pit stop in the compulsory pit stop. And I came out behind Rickard, and he was a few seconds up the road, but I caught him up with two or three laps to go. As we entered Druids, we kind of contacted lightly. He slid slightly wide. I went up the inside. Then as we were coming down through Bottom Bend, which in those days was flat out, there was my second teammate, Tiffany Dell, because he was doing a feature for Top Gear on the success of British touring cars. So the Nissan had kindly entered a third works car, and Tiff was driving that works car. So as we came into Surtees, Tiff kindly waved me through and then sort of more or less closed the door on Rickard. So I won the race. But then there was a big sort of, I mean, because Nigel Mansell was in that race, and Tiff and Nigel Mansell had a bit of a set to in the paddock. They'd never been the best of friends ever since Tiff felt that Nigel nicked his former three drive a number of years before. So there were quite a few of the sort of paparazzi-type people in the press conference, people you wouldn't normally expect to see there, you know, from the newspapers, and also people like Alan Henry, because I don't think, you know, Nigel had done well, but they, of course, had dragged him into the press conference along with the winners, myself and Rydell. The other thing was that when we came into Parc Fermé, I came in first. And then you can see from the in-car, which was shown later, but anyway, Rickard sort of pulled his steering wheel off, threw it on the dash, and came over and started throttling me live on ITV grandstand or whatever, in front of Steve Ryder. So there's all those elements to that particular weekend. And the size of the crowd, I mean, if you haven't been at the circuit by 7 o'clock, you weren't going to get in, 7 o'clock in the morning. It was ultimately they penalised me 2 seconds, and that meant I lost the win in that particular race. But it was still a very exciting, great race, I felt.
I can imagine. Mm. Well, Gary, I mean, bring you in here. Any alternatives to Anthony's career that you'd like to volunteer?
Well, I was talking about those MGs. I'm sure I've seen some of your BBC grandstand triumphs in the old... It was an Argo you raced, am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Argo JM14.
Yeah. Of course, for those younger listeners, I would just say that the grandstand series was for Formula Ford 2000 cars. It was held... all the races were at Brands Hatch, I think, except in 1 year when they had one at Snett or Fruxton or somewhere. It was an end of season winter series, and the races were shown on Saturday afternoon on Grandstand, which, again, for our younger listeners, was a sort of magazine show on BBC. So the races were shown a week late. But yeah, it seems unbelievable that we had sort of that sort of level of national racing on prime time BBC TV at the time,
with Murray Walker commentating.
Yeah. And let's not forget there were only four channels, four TV channels at that point. So it was a very big deal. And yeah, great names came through it. You know, yourself, Damon Hill, as you say, made his debut and didn't look particularly special. Julian Bailey, Mark Blundell, Paul Tracy, I do believe, did some races. Bertrand Farby, who was a great talent, also from Canada, who sadly died in Formula 3 testing. Yes, just some great drivers. Later on in the life of the series, someone like Piers Honeysett, who... you know, went on to do other things outside of driving in motorsport.
Formula Ford 1600 was a tremendous place to start your career. You know, because there weren't all these different formulas, and it was relatively affordable. And then to get the opportunity to race Formula Ford 2000, you know, in front of live television or recorded television on BBC Grandstand. And then Opel Lotus was another fantastic formula, which again was relatively affordable. To get those opportunities. Now these opportunities are extremely expensive. I mean, I help out some young kids and from time to time, and I just see what they're up against. The cost of going racing these days at a level where you might be able to make a bit of a name for yourself is just prohibitive.
Tiffany Dell, of course, has your teammate at Le Mans in 1990, has bought back his very first, well, the first racing car he owned, not the first racing car he raced, which is a Lotus 69 that he won in a competition in Autosport. He has that car back now, does a few historic Formula Ford races. Have you looked around to see if you can find your old PRS Formula Ford?
Yeah, no, I've seen Tiff's car, spoken to him about it, and he does a bit of blogging online, or whatever they call it, vlogging. I've been tempted. Probably when I had the spare cash, I could have bought the car that finished third at Le Mans for about 110,000 quid.
Just think how much it would be worth today, Anthony.
Yes.
Well, don't tell me about it.
The Japanese, the HKS Opel Vectra, well, Vauxhall Cavalier, but it was branded as an Opel Vectra. That would be quite a nice car to get if I could find out where it is. It's probably in somewhere like New Zealand. Formula 3 championship winning car would be quite nice.
What about the F? You raced an F40 in the early days of Japanese GTs. How do you fancy an F40 in the Ferrari F40 in the garage?
Again, an F40, the one that I raced, I could have bought that for about 100,000 quid.
Man. Then. See, if you'd have made these investments, we'd be talking to you now from your Bermuda beach house, wouldn't we?
Indeed.
Or in Saint-Tropez or wherever you'd be, not in Oxford.
I think I'm not alone in making the same mistake. Whether it's John Cleland having sold his Chevron B8 for 2,000 quid, or Richard Atwood having sold the Porsche 917. He made a tidy profit, but I think he sold a 250 GTO LM Ferrari to the guy from Sir Anthony Bamford. I think he sold it he couldn't get rid of it for a while, but he managed to sell it for 2,800 quid. When I see Richard says, shut up, I don't want to hear it. If I see him, at Goodwood or somewhere, don't talk to me about classic cars.
Oh, fantastic. Well, guys, I think we are going to have to bring the podcast to an end here. Now, normally I do a sort of frankly, faintly ridiculous, do I agree? Am I going to overrule these famous drivers like Juan Manuel Fangio, Michael Schumacher, Alan Prost? Am I going to disagree with their choices? It's frankly a bit arbitrary and a bit silly. But Anthony, seeing as we've got you here, of course I'm not going to do that. But I just think it's fantastic, that race that you chose, not only what it led to in your career, Gary, it started your long association going to Le Mans every year. So it's been fantastic to just talk about it with you guys today. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast, both of you.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks.
Excellent.
I really enjoyed it.
We'll just end with saying thank you very much to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, do get in touch with us on social media using our handle @Autosport. And do check out Anthony's Race of My Life, the full text that we'll be running on autosport.com. Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.